With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, I think we've decanted for long enough. It's time to sit back and enjoy Two Sharp Reds with Mark Schwarzer and Ollie Giel.
So too often we hear this is your favourite day of the week, Ollie Giel, but you know what? I have to say I'm pretty excited about it. For the first time, you've given me the opportunity to let loose and to run this show. And I'm going to take it. I'm trying to embrace it with both hands. So yes, it's this week. We are on the Two Sharp Reds with myself, Mark Schwarzer, and Ollie Giel, who's going to take a back seat for a change. Thank goodness, because his head is so massive. And if you haven't listened to us before, it's all about drinking wine, comparing a bottle of wine that either Ollie or myself drink together or separately. In the moment, because of COVID, we're separate. And we have a taste of it. We describe a little bit, talk about what it does for us, what parts of the palate it tingles the most. And then obviously at the end, we compare it to a footballer or somebody involved in football, past or present. So yeah, Ollie, welcome. Yeah, what did you think of my introduction this week?
Your introduction, Mark, was pretty good, but it's really the build-up that I liked the most. Just what you were nervous. Like that was... That was almost like watching you in the tunnel before a game, like just, you know, going through your rituals, you know, don't want to look anyone in the eye, that kind of thing. Like you were laser focused then for that intro.
You've just really made that up, haven't you? Because you've never known what I've done in a tunnel before a game, because was never one to stand there and not look someone in the eye because I felt nervous enough not to do that.
Were you a joker?
See, you don't even know. See, how can you compare that with me pre to a match?
Just assuming. I feel like you're the type of guy to just be laser focused. That's a compliment.
I was focused, absolutely, but it wasn't like I was so focused that I couldn't do anything else.
Right, okay.
I can multitask.
Well, I'm excited this week, and half the reason why I wanted you to do the intro is because, you know, when you talk about multitasking, not only have you been able to do the intro, but you've also remembered to turn your microphone on this week. So I think we're in for a really good episode.
Well, yeah, in my defense, I only just realized it that on this whole Zoom thing, you have to make sure that when you have a plug-in microphone, for anyone out there who's never done this before, or do plug their microphone and think that they're using the actual microphone they're plugged in, but in reality, you're not, unless you change the settings yourself manually.
Well, let's tick the wine off and then we can get stuck into the football, because mentioning Arsenal, I'm sure, as you would be well aware, I think we've got a fair bit we need to cover off. But this week I'm going for a Coonawarra Cabernet from South Australia. Picked a South Australian wine, not only because I really like it, but also my mum has driven into South Australia at the moment. So her and her husband have bought a caravan and they've driven from Sydney to Adelaide, and they've been spending some time around that Coonawarra area. So I've gone going for a Coonawarra Cabernet to celebrate their trip. What do you normally see other than nice Riojas? What do you normally see when you travel across Spain?
Well, Spain is similar. You know, when you go through, particularly like the middle of Spain, is very arid. It's very, very dry, hot. I mean, it's not quite desert, obviously, but it's very, very barren. But then, you know, Spain's obviously a big, big country. And it's funny enough, I didn't realize until more recently, and again, I checked it just the other day, I think it's 43 million people only live in Spain, you know, for a country that big in Europe. That's quite amazing. And it's obviously very vast, and then there's different climates. So if you're close to the Pyrenees, it's quite wet, and it's very much, you could easily say, well, you're almost in parts of Scotland, almost in the amount of rain that there is and how green it is.
Listen to this.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing. I love Northern Spain. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And I've got a lot of friends who actually are living, who live in Bilbao, come from the Basque area, are Basque. And when you ask the question, this is another funny thing, is that you ask a person from the Basque area, what are they? What do they class themselves? And they go, first, I'm from that. I'm Bilbao. I'm Basque. You know, I'm from that area. That's it. First and foremost.
I'm a Basque.
Yeah, absolutely. And then
Then they talk about, I think it's like, I can't remember what it was. There was another part they called themselves, and then they called themselves Spanish.
Right.
Which that's was bizarre. Like, it was, yeah, they're very, very patriotic about their area. And I'll tell you what, and this leads me right into my wine today. So because of obviously having a lot of friends from Bilbao, and when we are on holidays in Spain, right down the south, which is a place that a lot of people from Bilbao go to holiday in, even though it's about 10 hours straight down the country, they love their wine. They're very, very patriotic about their homegrown produce, and wine is one of those ones that they're very, very passionate about again. And this is a bottle of wine called a Ramon Bilbao Crianza 2017. It's one of quite a few that I've tasted over time, and it's a delicious little wine. It's a Rioja, and highly recommend that anyone who goes to Spain, and particularly if they go to well, you can have it anywhere in Spain, but if you go into the Basque area in Bilbao, which you should do because it's fantastic. Not only you've got the Guggenheim Museum, but it's a wonderful, wonderful city, and the wine is sensational. Cheers, mate.
So, Mark, for many reasons, as we know, 2020 in the world of football and the world itself has been a bizarre one and a really sad one. We've lost a lot of really notable people in our world, in the football world. And as we've talked about, the likes of Diego Maradona, and it's been a tough couple months in the football world, for a few big names. And we learnt only a matter of hours ago, Mark, of another great name that we've lost.
Yeah, unfortunately, overnight we lost a very, very special person in football, a guy that's particularly in this country, and as you mentioned, up on Merseyside there, as an ex-Liverpool manager, very well known and very well liked and respected throughout this country and the world of football. Gerard Houllier, unfortunately, lost his life overnight, which is very, very sad to hear again. I was fortunate enough on a couple of occasions to spend some time with him. And the last time I really spent any sort of significant amount of time with him was for about 2 hours. And it was back in 2016 in Milan. And I went across with a couple of mates to watch the Champions League final. And we caught up with Gerard at his hotel. And he was so accommodating. He was so nice. He was humble. He was passionate about football. And he was such a joy to be around. And he would talk to you he'd know everything about football, anything and everything. And he'd know about a moment. He'd remember a part of a game. He would talk about his time at running, being at Liverpool and his whole life experiences. And he just had such a passion and joy. And he was such a nice person to sit down. And he gave his time just to sit there and chat, talk all things football. So, yeah, it was really sad to hear overnight that he passed away.
And you can tell, as you just touched on there with your experiences with him, some of the posts we've seen as well, the likes of, your Steven Gerrards of the world and how highly they speak of him as well. I've never met him, but you can just tell some of those people in this world of football, there's a difference between, when someone talks about having a football brain, and I almost go, well, what does that mean? But when you talk about someone like your moment with Gerard there, where he just pick a year, pick a game, pick a moment, and it sounds like a really, really, beautiful person to be around to talk football.
Yeah, he was. I saw a post from Harry Kewell as well. He was the manager when Harry Kewell signed for Liverpool. And there is an outpouring of emotion with regards to Gerard Houllier and how much the players all loved him. Anyone who had any contact with him really respected him and really enjoyed their time with him. He won the treble with Liverpool, which was quite remarkable. He will be sorely missed, that's for sure.
So let's raise our glass, I would have thought, Mark, and a big toast to you, Gerard Houllier.
Absolutely.
So, Mark, let's get stuck into the football. It's a real case of a choose-your-own-adventure. There's so much we need to talk about. I want to delay talking about Arsenal just for a little bit longer. Is that all right? I need to build up to it. I need to build up with it. Get halfway through Makunawara, and then I'm good to go.
I get that. You need to be in the right headspace. Yeah.
Correct.
I
mean,
you'd be like going in two-footed. It'd be a bit like grabbing someone around the throat, wouldn't it?
Correct. Yeah. Oh. Jeez, you got me there. I really went, yeah, that's exactly what it'd be like. Oh, jeez. So before we do that, I want to talk about Champions League. The draw for the round of 16 has come out. Some ripping Fixtures. Tough one for Borussia Mönchengladbach. They take on Man City, Lazio and Bayern Munich. That'll be a really difficult game for them. I think we can all agree that Atletico Madrid and Chelsea is going to be an absolute ripper. Leipzig, Liverpool. Interesting that they've got each other. Porto, Juventus. Mouth-watering prospect in Barcelona and Paris. Sevilla, Dortmund, Atalanta and Real Madrid. Are we looking at Atletico and Chelsea? Is that the one, do we think?
No, I mean, the mouth-watering one, I think, in terms of names and the, I suppose, the iconic players and player playing against the next club, has to be Barcelona PSG. I mean, Neymar coming up against Barcelona and Messi. Barcelona obviously not being at the level that they've been in the past, but it's still, on paper, is a huge, huge game. I mean, this is the thing about Champions League football at this stage of the competition. Every game is a big one. And you could pick out every one of those games for various reasons and say, this is amazing. There's so intriguing. I mean, even, you know, Sevilla, Dortmund, Sevilla with Lopetegui in charge, Sevilla's history and winning the Europa League, so successful over the years. Now they're in the big league, they're in the Champions League, and they're in the knockout stage. They come up against a Dortmund side who have just lost their manager. Obviously, the games are not going to take place until later on next year. So a lot can change between now and then. So, but on paper, right this moment, they're mouth-watering. Lazio, Bayern, Bayern, Lazio lost in the weekend. Bayern, you know, dropped points against Union Berlin. Mönchengladbach have been pretty inconsistent in the Bundesliga this season, but been excellent. Obviously lost their last Champions League game against Real Madrid and only got through because Inter Milan could only manage a draw against Shakhtar Donetsk, and a Manchester City who are at the moment kind of misfiring a little bit as well. So every game, Porto, Juve, Ronaldo going back to Portugal, coming up against Porto, you know, he played for Sporting Lisbon. You know, there's so much to talk about. Leipzig, Liverpool, you mentioned. Atletico, Chelsea, the history. My last ever Champions League game. Well, my last two Champions League games, which was a semi-final against Atletico Madrid for Chelsea. So there is history there. Atletico won that game. I won one over two legs, 0-0 in Madrid, and we lost 3-1 at home. So yeah, you can go all day long. Atalanta, Real Madrid. Atalanta last season, they're not quite up there this season in terms of league performances and league form. However, they made the knockout stages of the Champions League, and Real Madrid have kind of stuttered a little bit. Yeah. A big win on the weekend against Atletico Madrid, but they've been inconsistent as well. But again, I'll go back to it. These games are still a while away.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I can't wait already. You know, we actually talked about last week, didn't we? We feel like we've been inundated with football. It's like we can't remember. There's always games on, and then all of a sudden, we don't have Champions League or Europa League this week. And I go, oh, come on. There's no secret here on the Two Sharp Reds that we love our Premier League football. And we always will keep a special eye on Premier League sides. So between City, Chelsea and Liverpool, are we pretty confident all three of those should progress? Or is Chelsea the real, that's going to be the question mark?
Listen, I think, you know, it's hard because in a couple of months' time is when these games take place. But if those games were to take place next week, I don't think either of them are a straightforward fixture for any of the teams, you know, but we're talking a couple of months down the line. So it's so difficult to predict at this stage. On paper, Atletico Chelsea is going to be a really, really tight and tough encounter for Chelsea and Atletico. Leipzig, Liverpool, Leipzig. You know, I think after losing to Manchester United 5-0 in the Champions League, they've redeemed themselves and they deserve to be in the knockout stages. Liverpool, for all their injuries they've had, you know, it's remarkable where they still are in the league. You know, they just lost Jota now for another probably a couple of months. It's ridiculous, and they're still where they are. I mean, they're equal points at the top of the table, you know. So they're not far, you know. And you would hope for Liverpool, you would think, you know, Jota will be back. There'll be maybe a few players. Obviously, Van Dijk and Gomez are definitely out for the vast majority of the season. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's too early to predict right now.
You sent me an unbelievable message this morning. The Champions League draw, you mentioned that, talking about Europa League, with all major five leagues in Europe, so La Liga, Premier League, Bundesliga, Serie A, and Ligue 1, all five leagues, whoever is on top at the moment, they're all in the Europa League draw. That is bizarre. So you got Real Sociedad, Tottenham, Leverkusen, Milan, and Lille. I mean, that. I mean, it's 2020, I suppose. Like, when are we going to stop being surprised by things?
Yeah, but you know what? It's remarkable that it's happened this weekend, when today was obviously the draw for Europa League and Champions League. So, but they're all tight, aren't they? There's no one running away with it. They're very, very tight. Next week, there could be different leaders, but it's just ironic that it happened just this week.
Yeah.
And it is. It's quite remarkable. And you know, it's always, you know, 2020 has been like no other. End of 2021 will be a little bit like 2020. So there will be another one like it, kind of.
Sure. Yeah.
But at the moment, 2020 is like no other, and it's going to be so unpredictable. I don't know. I just don't see any league really having a runaway winner in those top five leagues. I think it's going to be a very tight season. There's so many games. Players are still chasing their tails, trying to get back to fitness, find their form, dealing with the fact that I don't care what anyone says. You know, I thought initially, I thought it was always going to be a challenge for teams to play without fans. I was at a couple of games on the weekend. I was at the Midlands Derby, Wolves against Aston Villa. They didn't have any fans because of being in a restriction three zone. And it was kind of, there was passion. They were sending offs. But again, it's nothing like having a full stadium with that atmosphere. And then I was at Palace against Spurs. And those 2,000 Palace fans made a hell of a difference. You know, it drove Palace on. And yeah. I mean, Tottenham played their part. They dropped off and became more negative, but those fans had a big part to play. And I was doing some radio at the time. And just before kickoff, the managers come out of the tunnel. And the tunnel at Selhurst Park is at the corner of one end. Mm-hmm. So you've got to walk down, you know, half the length of the pitch. And they come out at sort of the hardcore end of the Palace fans, and there were obviously a couple of hundred fans there, but they made a noise. I mean, obviously it's not like a full stadium, but they made a tremendous noise. And Roy Hodgson is 73 years old, turned around, he had this biggest smile on his face from ear to ear, and he was applauding the crowd for at least probably 20, 30 seconds, because he was just, you could see it. He was like a little kid in a candy shop.
Yeah.
He just couldn't believe it, and he was so excited. And that made a huge difference. And then there were moments also in the game when a decision went against Palace and the boos were ringing around. It was like you literally went, well, actually, hang on, wow, we've got fans back again.
Yeah.
And it was so, so nice. And I said in the commentary, actually, don't you love a boo? It's fantastic to hear the boos again. And it was. It was one of those moments where I was like, I got more excited for the fact that people were booing an incident in the game rather than getting too excited about cheering it. It was just real again.
It's funny though, you know, your thoughts on the Crystal Palace game and how that the fans really helped. On the other side, and I think I'm ready to talk about it now, Mark, given the fact that there's only 2,000 allowed in, it's always going to be a little awkward if the fans actually haven't helped the team. And all of a sudden, you've got 2,000 fans walking out and booing, which was the case at the Emirates.
Isn't that so Arsenal fans though? Mm-hmm. A walkout? Do they not love?
They love it, mate. They love a walkout.
I don't get it. Like, you've got 2,000 people who had the luxury to be chosen to go or get watch a game, and I get it. It's their team, and they were rubbish, right? I get it. I understand it. But do you not support your team through thick and thin? Do you not stay there until the end? You got to suffer it. You got to go through it. And particularly at this moment in time when they've had like 8, 9 months, 10 months, whatever it is, without fans in a game. And it's just like, I just don't get it. I don't understand why they walked out. I really don't.
All I'd say is that it is a privilege to be able to get tickets in this scenario. So I'm like, well, okay, I totally respect that. But it's going to people that have season tickets, you know, that have gone all their life. You know, if someone was flying over from Australia and this was their first Arsenal game and you couldn't believe their luck, there's no way they're walking out, even if it was 10-0 to Burnley. Yeah,
but let's be honest, there's no one flying over from Australia to watch an Arsenal game right now. Nor are they watching any game. I'm not having a dig at Arsenal here. I'm talking about that there isn't anyone flying over. So there's no international fans really coming in. So, you know, listen, of course you've got to give it to season ticket holders, 100%. I just question the support. I question that. I've been in those situations before whereby you've you know, you're under pressure, you're in a really bad run of form, everything's going against you, the performances are not good enough, 100%. And you've got to hold your hand up as players. But and you understand when fans voice their disapproval, but you also need their support. You need them to try and help you get out of it, you know, because sometimes that extra bit of support in the stadium on that particular day, that moment in a game, can make a difference.
So what breaks the cycle, though, in this scenario? Because it just feels like a dog chasing its tail. You know, fans want, you know, the team to win because, you know, they need that. And, you know, they're paying a lot of money to see their team win. But they're not supporting them because they're not winning. But they're not winning, arguably, because they're not getting any support.
Yeah, because, it's not because they're not winning. It's not that they're not winning games because they've got no support. They have got support. It's just the type of support that they're receiving at the moment. What actually ended up happening, and I've had this before and I've experienced it before, where you're in the change rooms and the talk comes up, right, forget that lot out there because they're not going to support us right now. We have to get ourselves back on track to get them back on track and get them back on our side. So you're almost left in a scenario where it's them against you almost, and you've got to do it yourself. You can't rely on
that. That's not healthy, though, is it?
No,
it can't be healthy.
But that happens because of the relationship is so soured, and so there's such a division that the only way that you get out of it is by that group of players in that change room, the manager, the players, turning it around and having to win the support back again. And
where did that happen to you?
Oh, it happened at various times at Middlesbrough. I mean, I was there for nearly 12 years. So you have up and down periods. It didn't actually happen at Fulham because, I mean, I think we, you know, even though we got to a European Cup final, I just think they realised that that was just a remarkable accomplishment, and it was potentially only ever a one-off, and they were just happy with staying in the league from that point onwards, and maybe trying to build on it and try and go on another European run, get into European places somehow, but they kind of understood that it was so tough. I think with Middlesbrough, because it was over a longer period of time, we won the cup 2 years prior, the League Cup. We toyed with the idea a few times. We played European football the season before and got knocked out of the quarters against Sporting Lisbon. And then we qualified on the very end of the last season, the last game of the season, for the Europa League again. And we went on that run. And they kind of thought we'd kick on and go to it. They believed that we were going to go on to another level. They thought there was a lot of talk from a lot of fans that, right, now we're going to go for Champions League positions. Now we're going to take it to another step. But we were way off it. And then if you look at the cutbacks that were made, Steve McCarron left. He put Gareth Southgate from player into manager, first ever job. And Gareth, if you talk to Gareth right now about it, and I have spoken to Gareth about it over the last couple of years, and he said, yeah, at the time, it was too soon for me. You know, but it was a job that I couldn't turn down. And coming to terms with how big a job it was. He wanted to go into management, and I remember him saying to me once, in hindsight, I probably should have fulfilled my last year of my contract in terms of playing and then looked to get into management. But he said it was so difficult to say no, because when you've got a club that's established team in the Premier League offering you the opportunity to become manager, how do you turn that down? So I understand why he took it, but it was a hell of a gamble. And in the end, unfortunately, it didn't kind of pay off. And that's not down to him necessarily, because there were a lot of cutbacks. There were a lot of decisions made where they were reducing the wage bill, they were reducing the spend on the team, and they were trying to get through with young talent, and they were trying to rebuild a team. They did it too quickly. They made the wrong decisions with so many players, and ultimately that cost them. And now they've become that team that, well, they're not even a yo-yo team anymore. They've just become a team that will pop up every now and then and try their luck in the Premier League, and now they're a championship side that are hopeful to get promotion. And they're kind of now at the moment, they're definitely still top half of the table, but at the moment they're looking only just.
So it's an interesting point you bring up about Gareth, and you know, it must be so difficult to turn down a job like that. So when we're talking about this game in particular with Arsenal, you know, clearly Mikel Arteta has learnt from the best. He wants to be a manager. Arsenal come knocking. It's going to be very difficult to say no. But do we think now in hindsight, he should have been maybe thinking a little bit like Gareth was thinking, it's too big of a step. It's too big, because one thing I don't want is for his career to end before it starts. You know, this could be a really, really horrible, I mean, it already is a pretty horrible way to kick your career off. But one thing I would say, do we need to remember, and we know what Arsenal fans are like, they're very, very present, I'd say, online, and they're very vocal, you know, get him out, all that sort of stuff. But when you look at that game, how much of it was really to blame on Mikel Arteta? I mean, Xhaka, we could have been managed by literally anyone in the world. You go like that.
Yeah,
madness.
He was let down massively by his players, and unfortunately, he was let down massively by one of his more experienced players, and that would be for Mikel Arteta probably one of the most difficult things to take. You could argue all day long about tactics and about team selections and so forth, but if you pick a team and you believe that you have the right team, the right mix, and particularly you've got a bunch of experienced players that you're relying heavily on, and one of your most experienced players lets you down in that way, I mean, no manager could really predict that. So I feel for Mikel Arteta in this instance. But overall, I mean, the team are where they are partly because of because of Mikel Arteta and his. They're all together. You know, they're all joining together. They all have to take responsibility for it. And then the club get to a point where they make a decision. They say, well, okay, is it the manager's problem? Is it his fault, sorry? Or is it that the players are not good enough and the players all need to be changed? 99.9% of the time, the club won't change all the players. They'll change the manager because that's the easiest one. It's one person they need to replace rather than 11, 12, 15 players, sure, whatever they want to do. So he ultimately is going to be the fall guy if it comes to that. And to go back to your question, whether or not he should have taken the job, or has he taken it too soon? No, listen, he did his apprenticeship, so to speak. I mean, the one thing you may ask is that, and question, and I actually do this, I do question a lot of managers' decisions when it comes to playing a style of football, and playing a style of football that doesn't necessarily support or suit the players that you have at your disposal. And there's a transitional period. So you want to play a certain way, but then you've got to identify whether or not you have the players to play that. And even if you go for it and you try it, it doesn't work, you've got to adapt things. You've got to change your style a little bit to suit the players that you have to then get you to a certain point. Mm-hmm. And then come that next transfer window, you hope to change things. You know, you try and bring in one or two more players that will suit the way you play. But what a lot of managers do, they change everything to play a certain way right from the off, and they won't change anything because that's the way they want to play. And that's the way football should be played in their eye, or that's how their style is, and they won't change anything. I think that's all wrapped in management. You've got to be able to identify the type of players you have, the squad that you have, and decide whether or not they are good enough and suited to the way you ideally would like to play. And if not, then you've got to find alternative ways to at least sort of look like that team, but you work towards it. And it may take some time to work towards it, but you've got to be competitive. You've got to win games still, you've got to get points on the table. And then there's a gradual transition of changing a team into a certain style.
Is it clear to you from an outsider's point of view that Arsenal have a discipline problem? And not in terms of if you were to compare some of these players to say, for example, a Jack Grealish who's been seen, you know, breaking, you know, lockdown rules for parties, and, you know, Arsenal don't seem to have that sort of issue when it comes to discipline. But when you think about in the last calendar year, for example, you've got the Guendouzi incident at Brighton and what's sort of going on there. You've got Saliba who's still posting about how he, on Instagram, that he feels he's locked up. You've got Pepe who's headbutting. You've got even Elneny in that game against Burnley. It just feels like there's a genuine discipline problem. That's how I'm looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line, isn't there, between showing passion, being assertive or aggressive on a football pitch, to fouling and just making stupid decisions. And what you saw on the weekend with Arsenal, and to particularly, you know, Granit Xhaka and Elneny, they're both experienced players, made stupid decisions. Elneny was very, very fortunate. I thought he'd be sent off. I thought it was very, very fortunate not to get a red card. And if the ball were in play, it would have been a penalty as well. So, you know, to me, I think that reeks of a team that is under an enormous amount of pressure. They're feeling the pressure. They're feeling they've got frustration. And whether that's to do with frustration with partly to do with the manager, the way they're playing, the team's playing or not playing, certain players are not performing. I think there's a combination of everything. The pressure they feel from the fans, from the media. They know, listen, Arsenal at this rate are in genuine danger of being sucked into a relegation fight, which is just ridiculous to think that that's even possible.
They already are in one at the moment.
It's still very, very early. So I wouldn't class them into being that regular, that genuine fight for survival just yet. But they are in danger of being one of those teams who are not careful. And this whole thing about, you know, you're too good to go down. There's none of that. If you're not organized enough, if you haven't got the confidence, you haven't got the unity, the right type of personnel, the right type of characters in that change room, you can be in trouble.
Is it bad for me to say as a massive fan? And don't worry, I am. I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit, but I kind of wouldn't mind seeing what would happen if they went down. Just almost just like a total circuit breaker, a shock to the system. And it'd start to scare teams again. It might be an opportunity to almost strip the club down and build it back up from the start. It'd just be interesting to see what would happen.
Well,
we've seen what's happened with Leeds, I suppose. Yeah.
And very much, you know, you could say that Leeds side that got relegated, how was that even possible?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's kind of almost, that Leeds side that got relegated is far better side than this Arsenal side is right now. I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's the warning, you know. The warning is if you don't get things right, and then obviously clearly Leeds didn't have things right on the football pitch or off the football pitch because it all led to their demise. And that the danger is at Arsenal is that I don't think it'll come to it. Listen, I think Arsenal are way too good for that. And I think they will get it right. Whether they get it right with Mikel Arteta or someone else is a different conversation. But, oh, geez, how funny would it be and how brilliant would it be if Pochettino took over as manager? Oh, my God. Imagine if when Pochettino gets asked that question, Poch, we fancy you. Who am I speaking to? It's Arsenal. choking on his cornflakes.
How good would the North London derby be with Jose God. In one end, Poch in the other?
One of those ones. Poch has said it himself. I could never manage Real Madrid. And how he's regretted saying that. It's like Jose saying, I would never, ever manage Tottenham. And look where we are. You know, I get there's a sense of loyalty, right? And I get that. You have a relationship with a group of fans. But, you know, we are in, you know, we're in year 2020, almost 21. And, you know, yes, there's rivalry, there's the derbies, but no longer is a case. It's a sin that you can't go from one to the other because it's happened over time and it will continue to happen. And it happens more often, I think, these days than it ever has.
Yeah.
You know, and I, the longer Poch goes without a job, and if the Arsenal opportunity comes up, career-wise, it'd be mad not to take it. Because what a job that is. It's an amazing job to take.
Won't be long, I promise. Back to Ollie and Mark in just 15 seconds. If you enjoy Two Sharp Reds, though, make sure you search the Gegenpod wherever you get your podcasts. David Wiener is joined by thousands of games of experience both on and off the field. It's a great listen. Gegenpod, the Gegenpod. Okay, back to Two Sharp Reds.
Half done drinks here on the Two Sharp Reds. Just thought it was an appropriate time to get into Mukuna Wara Cabernet.
After that, I think you need it.
I deserve it. I don't know. There's need, deserve.
Do you deserve it? Let's be honest, do you? I just think you need it.
Hey, Mark, yesterday had a good moment. That, you know, it was sad that you weren't there, really. In the last 15 minutes of the game between Fulham and Liverpool, had a nice mulled wine in the rain. Yeah, and I was watching it and...
You were watching it in the rain?
No, well, as in... There's a bar near me that's outside, but it's got the roof, and they've got the screens up. And I didn't know what was better, you know, my mulled wine or that game.
Yeah, it was a great game, wasn't it? It was entertaining. Fulham deservedly should have been probably even more up in the first half. Unfortunate, I think very unfortunate with the penalty decision that went against them in terms of not getting a penalty. I think it was that close. It was so tough to call. Even with the VAR, it was still, I mean, it's still, people are divided in terms of whether it should have been a penalty or not. I'm not sure because I haven't really seen it well enough with the VAR decision and the video replay. So I can't really say. I just know it was really, really tight. And obviously, the Liverpool penalty was a penalty. I've got no complaints about that. That to me, yeah, definitely a penalty. Areola played his part, played really well. Thought he should have saved the penalty. Thought he moved too much because he's that good. Like I just thought he got a hand on it. You could see his reaction. He was really kind of like upset, disappointed that he didn't save it because I thought he was going to save it. He's a very good goalkeeper. And listen, I'll take my hand off. I'll hold my hand up. Fulham surprised me. Last three games, they have been a team that looks like they have a chance to stay in the Premier League. But it's only off three games, right? But the signs there are very positive. To pick up 4 points out of nine against Leicester, Manchester City and Liverpool.
Huge. Well,
they would have signed off on that months ago.
Mm. So they're now sitting at 2 wins, 2 draws, 8 losses. So 8 points, which also means they are only, oh, that's good, only 5 points away from Arsenal. So that's good. I'm just doing the maths here. But they're 1 point out of the relegation zone. So, yeah, is it time to start thinking that, not that they're going to kick on and, you know, finish mid-table, but do we think that they've shown enough to suggest that they've got enough bottle in them to get themselves out of a scrap when push comes to shove?
Listen, it's going to be topsy-turvy all season for the likes of Fulham. What Fulham have to do is they have to try and be that 17th team. That's what they need to aim for. Anything above that is an absolute bonus, of course. But 17th is their goal. And if they can just stay in the league this season and then build upon that platform, that is the challenge. It's a bit like what Villa did last season. So we just need a goal line decision to go our way. Don't turn the machine on when they're up our end. Yep. And then we can stay up. But you know what I mean? Like it's just totally. They've got to earn the respect, earn the right. And they've the positive thing about it this time around Fulham, as opposed to a couple of years ago, we're 12 games in and they look a hell of a lot more positive now than they did back then. Back then when Jukanovic was the manager, after 12 games, they'd actually replaced the goalkeeper. They had three different goalkeepers they'd been playing. They didn't play with the same team once. There was no kind of understanding of who their best team was. And they were all over the place. And they were gone before the season even started, really. Whereas this one, I do give them a chance now. Whereas a couple of weeks ago, and for a number of weeks, I just thought there was no hope at all.
Are we comfortable in writing off Sheffield United? No wins, 1 draw, 11 losses. So the 1 point.
Sheffield United are one of those sides that they know what it's like to stay in the Premier League. They had an amazing season last season. The vast majority of the team is still the same side. And I think they're one result away from potentially going on a bit of a run. And they could go on a run. I think that one of the issues is going to be that I don't think fans will be back into the stadiums until probably around April time, maybe
in
even
Sheffield.
Later. Yeah, well, across the country. But like, I mean, a substantial amount of fans, you know, we're getting back to some sort of normality, hopefully, fingers crossed, right? Just my own personal view. And I think that'll be way too late for Sheffield United. And I think they're one of the teams that are struggling without any fans. And they've been affected by the, you know, being one of the most affected sides.
So, Mark, preview time, massive game this Wednesday between Liverpool and Tottenham. Now, this is going to be a seriously.
I thought you were going to say Fulham against Brighton.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, there's some big games no matter where you look, to be honest, mate, aren't there? Just go, you know, Arsenal, Southampton.
Well,
Leicester, Everton.
That's an away win, isn't it?
Away win, yeah.
Arsenal, Southampton's away win. That's odds on if I were a betting man.
No, but we've got to talk about Liverpool-Tottenham. I'm so excited for this. So we're currently looking at first versus second. They've both got 7 wins, 4 draws, 1 loss, sitting at 25 points. How do you reckon, and you've been in big games, that infamous game in 2014 under Jose, how would he be preparing for this, do you think?
I think he'll be pretty much preparing very much the same way as when they were playing against Manchester City. They'll go out there, they'll look to sit back. They know they won't have as much of the ball as say, Liverpool. And they will look to be that side again that counters them and are ruthless on the counter. I saw an interesting table today or a couple of tables today. And it's the first half performances of a team after 12 games, what the table would look like, and Spurs are top.
Yep.
And then when they put the table up of the second half 45 minutes what the table would look like, and it was Liverpool top and Spurs were way off. So it's literally, if it's going true to form as it has so far this season, it's going to be literally a tale of two halves. as it tends to be with Spurs, when Spurs play and Liverpool this season, is that, you know, one half is not their best, and then the second, and then the other half has been their best. You know, what you expect from them. And Spurs were very much like that on the weekend against Crystal Palace. First half, they were good. They were dominating. They had possession. They should have scored more. They got lucky with the goal they scored because Guaita made a mistake. But, you know, funny enough, like, he made a mistake that cost him a goal for Palace, but he was the best player on the pitch.
Yeah.
Because he made some brilliant saves, and he was the way he recovered, the way he performed before the mistake, then the way, even more impressive, was the way that he recovered from the mistake. So Spurs didn't protect their chances, didn't put the opposition away. Liverpool probably were fortunate enough only to be a goal down against Fulham. And so second half performance was far more befitting a Liverpool side. And so it's going to be a really, really intriguing encounter between the two. Liverpool can't start badly again. Spurs can't drop off like they did in the second half against Palace, because they'll get punished by Liverpool.
This seems like the sort of game, though, you know, as fans, we've been really lucky with, you know, getting that insight through Amazon as to, you know, the way Jose speaks to his players and his mindset, and, you know, learning a bit more about him. But this strikes me as the sort of game where he comes into his own. Like, this, right, how can I, is there a psychological edge? Is there something that I can do or say to certain players? You know, it wouldn't surprise me, as we've seen Dele Alli, mate, you know, just the old appearance now for Tottenham. It wouldn't surprise me if he did something, you know, in the next couple of days to pump him right up. Dele starts and has an absolute blinder.
Yeah, you know what? Watching the game the other night, I mean, Dele came on. He hasn't featured very much this season at all under Jose. There's been a lot of speculation about him leaving the club in January. PSG, the likely destination at this moment in time, if you believe the rumours. I just can't see him getting in the side really at the moment. I just think that Jose has his kind of formation. He has his team. He has his players that he believes are the right ones. And where's Dele going to play? You know, whose position, whose place is he going to take from that current starting 11 side? I mean, obviously Kane, Son's not going to be replaced unless they're injured. There's no way in the world that he's going to take anything from those guys. You look at midfield, Højbjerg and Sissoko. There's no way in the world Dele would do that same job anyway. So I just find it difficult to see how Dele Alli, in his current form, when I say current form, you know, the way that he plays, full stop, I just don't see where, I mean, and Ndombele is a different player. You know, he's a completely different player now. He's rolled his sleeves up, which I have to take my hat off to him, because he's rolled his sleeves up. He's taken on the chin the criticism, and he's gone, right, I'm going to prove him wrong, the manager. And that's the thing about Jose. He may have a dig at you. And a lot of the times, 99% of the time, if he has a dig at you, it's because you need it, because you've made a mistake and you need it, and he wants a response. And he feels that this is the best way I'm going to get a response from it. He may be wrong. Sometimes he gets that wrong. It's only normal. But most of the time, he gets it right. And it really depends. When I say gets it right, he gets it right in terms of, I sit back and go, he's done the right thing there. Now, what the interesting thing is, how does the player react? And initially, Ndombele threw his toys out of the pram, had a bit of a sulk. But that's how it came across. And something's happened in the meantime, and he's obviously rolled his sleeves up and gone, right, okay, I'm gonna prove you wrong. And he has. And not proved him wrong, proved him right in a lot of ways, because Jose's pushed the buttons to try and lift him to the level that he knows he can play, or at least he expects him to be able to play it. And Ndombele is starting to do that. He's starting to be that player that he was at Lyon, because once he came to Spurs, he wasn't that player anymore, and he was nowhere near at that level. So Jose's getting him back to that level, or helping him get him back to that level. Obviously, it's down to the player, and he's doing that. Steven Bergwijn, where's Dele Alli going to play? He's not going to play ahead of this guy, because this guy works. Yeah. And he was like, at times, Serge Aurier, if he was caught out or if he was tucked inside picking up a runner, Steven Bergwijn was right back there, right back. The work rate was insane. And Jose loves that. Son, work rate is brilliant. Harry Kane. Every one of those players works their socks off. Dele Alli, I just don't know what he brings. If he brings him on late, maybe as an aerial threat in the box, you know, do something from something, you know, like from nothing, create something from nothing, maybe ball pops down, maybe. Otherwise, I just don't seem currently fitting in this side.
Mark, before we wrap things up here on the Two Sharp Reds, it's time that we swap our red wine for a very nice Weissbier, cross over to your part of the world in Germany for your Bundesliga update, because we touched on it when talking about Champions League football and Dortmund in the news that they have sacked Favre. I mean, talk to me. What's going on? What's happening with it?
Yeah, so Lucien Favre, it's no surprise that he's lost his job. There's been speculation for a number of seasons now. There are times where they've dipped in form a little bit, and there was talk about whether or not he was the right man for the job. And there was a real split as to whether or not people believed he was or not. And then obviously he's kept hold of his job, and he's done a pretty good job, really, considering they sell players, they bring in another young crop of young players, and they bring them through, and they've done really, really well. But unfortunately, due to the poor form, particularly league form of late, they've only won 1 in 5. Going back to, they lost to Bayern Munich at home on the 7th of November. From that point onwards, they only won one game in the league, and that was a way to Hertha Berlin. They won a couple of Champions League games in between, which was obviously always a bit of a positive, but they want to be competitive. They want to be up there or thereabouts for the Bundesliga title, and now they're a bit off the pace. They lost to Cologne, which is a kind of a local derby, and then they drew to Frankfurt, and then on the weekend was the final nail in the coffin. And I think it was more about the way that they lost the game. They lost 5-1. They got hammered, of course, against VfB Stuttgart, a newly promoted side in the Bundesliga. So it just really rubbed salt into the wound.
And well, because they've only lost 4 games, though. So it really, that you think it's more the way that they're losing, not that the fact that they are.
Yeah. And I think it's the same old problems that are kind of reoccurring. You know, it's not like whenever they dip in form, it's because of the same problems, the way that they're playing and the style of football he's trying to get his players to play. And a lot of poor decisions from players on the pitch, and particularly younger players that they allowed to express themselves all the time. And then, you know, if you need to be competitive in the league, and you need to be competitive in the Champions League, plus produce players, you're going to have to do a lot more right on the football pitch. And at times, they make too many mistakes because they're allowing the young players to just go and express themselves at times. And I think it's the case of not really getting hold of these guys enough as a manager and letting them make mistakes, but then they've got to learn. You know, but what happens is the same mistakes are reoccurring, and more often than not, the same players are making those mistakes. So, yeah, I think in the end, they just decided this is done. All the talk is that they've agreed a deal with Marco Rose from Borussia Mönchengladbach to take over as manager in the summer. That's the speculation at the moment. It seems pretty certain. I straight away thought, you know, Arsenal target Mauricio Pochettino would be a great fit for them.
What about Allegri?
Maybe that. I mean, the question is, I'm just trying to think. Allegri, when you think about Allegri at Juve, there's no doubting his experience and his qualities, and he's won titles. Oh, you know, I'm not going to disagree with that one bit. But I'm kind of trying to think about that mixture of developing young players, having success in the team, with Juve, and a lot of experienced players, and he managed those very, very well. There wasn't a lot of young players coming through. And at Dortmund, they need to do that. They need to bring through young players. I mean, you know, you see it time and time again, whether it's Sancho, Reina, you know, Billinghurst. It's the young players that are coming through. Bellingham, coming through. And it's important that they keep developing these young players and giving them experience. And then for the view of then shipping them on to make a huge profit out of it. And I just don't see Allegri doing that. Whereas Mauricio Pochettino, I think that's a perfect fit.
Mark, let's talk shop. It's time to wrap things up here on the Two Sharp Reds and discuss red wine. I've really liked the Coonawarra Cabernet. So, of course, it's from the Coonawarra region in South Australia. Pretty much has the reputation of producing the country's best Cab Sav. It's ripe, really nice blackcurrant fruits. Very generous and satisfying. It does say here, though, that it goes perfectly with a Sunday roast or veal. Now, you're the sort of man that I think would go for the veal over the Sunday roast, wouldn't you? Well, in terms of the veal as the meat in the Sunday roast.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do like my veal. I'm not going to doubt that. That's not going to argue with that.
Also goes perfectly with a grilled lamb steak recipe.
Oh, I
recipe.
Love it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, love my you. Lamb. Oh, I'm salivating.
Look at that. Have you had the tomahawk steak, by the way?
Or I have, yes.
Right up your
yeah,
room.
I have. Yeah. You know where I had it? I had it in the summer. I had it in a restaurant down in the south of Spain near Cardiff, and the meat came from Bilbao because they are a big producer of meat in Spain, which is beautiful.
So I'll kick things off. I'll just get things underway here and comparing my player to this bottle of wine. There's a few things that stand out. Ripe. So this wine and player is supposed to be in sort of the best form of their career, supposedly. It does say it's supposed to be a satisfying wine, but I'm going to say it was unsatisfying for me. I think I wanted it to be so satisfying because of, you know, because it said, and I went, actually, you know what? I'm slightly unsatisfied by this. Also, a lot of variant expressions. Lots of varying expressions in a player, you know, this is a man who can, you know, do anything on any day, very unpredictable, but his face normally tells the story, and it's normally quite unsatisfying. There's a lot of erratic tastes in this wine in terms of, I'm not a massive Cab Sav fan, so I don't really know what it's like. What am I tasting? Whereas when I have a Shiraz or a Pinot, it feels very clear to me, but there's a lot of erratic tastes that I can't pinpoint, which also leads me on to the fact that I feel like there's an unspecific use for me. What's it for? You know, really, it says it's nice for a Sunday roast or with veal or with a grilled lamb recipe. You know, it's all a bit up in the air for me. So when I think about ripe in age, unsatisfying, erratic tastes with an unspecific use, I think it's harsh of me, but probably appropriate that I compare this player to one Granit Xhaka. Good? That's yeah. All right?
Made me chuckle. I like it.
Yeah, you like that one, didn't you?
Yeah, made me chuckle, yeah.
I like it when I make you laugh. It's just, yeah, good.
That's very good. Right, mine is Ramon Bilbao Crianza 2017 Rioja. Delightful wine. I've had it on a number of occasions. Rioja, we know there's full-bodied, strong, nice taste. If you love your big, fruity, big, heavy wines, a Rioja is always a good one. And, you know, it's right up your alley again. But I do like them. I do really like – it's funny because, and any regular listeners will know that I'm not necessarily a big Shiraz fan, but – you know, I kind of contradict myself when it comes to Rioja because it's pretty strong and full-bodied normally as well. This one is well-balanced, fruity character and friendly way. It's a long finish with balsamic and fruity notes.
Balsamic? That's yeah. A bit... Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it has its intense nose, red fruit, berries of the forest, licorice, sweet spices. So remember that, sweet spices.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's going to have a bit of influence on my decision or my comparison to a player. And it's something that I have to say, this player who I know is very friendly, so fruity character in a friendly way. It's a longish sort of finish in terms of his career, his position. He's well balanced. And maybe that's got to do with the sense that he's got a bit of quite a low center of gravity, sort of balance of, you know, he's quite lower centered, quite shortish. You know, he's, let's say, fruity character. He's full of character. He's a really good guy once you get to know him. And
is this me? Sorry, are you comparing
me? Yeah, well, it's close. I mean, similarities, I suppose, in terms of low sort of center of gravity. The sweet spices. So when you think of spices, you're thinking of Asian. Well, I do anyway when I think of spices. And he's a guy that I spent a bit of time with when I was at Leicester City, if that helps you in any way.
Yeah, I know, and man.
Because this wine is from the Basque area, he is playing in northern Spain and had a tremendous season last season with a very, very unfancied side. And they got promoted into La Liga from the second division in Spain. And I messaged him after that happened, and he was delighted, of course, and he said to me that he was then staying in Spain for another season. And funny enough, we had organised that I was going to come over and they were going to play Bilbao. They're playing Bilbao on the 20th of December. So I'll wait to Bilbao and I was going to go over there. And because of all our friends in Bilbao, we were hopeful. We were very optimistically hopeful that maybe we'd be able to go to a game and watch it. But unfortunately, that's never going to be the case. And we're not going to be able to go to Spain, unfortunately. But it's none other than Shinji Okazaki, who plays for Huesca in La Liga.
What a man. That, mate, that's one of your best comparisons. Yeah. I mean, I've never met him, but that is exactly the way. He looks so friendly. Mark, you did the intro this time around, so I'll do your job and do the outro for Two Sharp Reds. But that's all the time we've got here on the Two Sharp Reds. It's been a fantastic episode. We've cried, we've laughed,
you've cried anyway.
I've cried, you've laughed. Yeah, there you go. We've got some big games coming up, plenty going on. Stay around these channels and get in touch with us on Two Sharp Reds on Facebook, in our private Facebook group, because we will have that Q&A coming up, which I'm very much looking forward to. And also, keep in touch with everything around the Optus Sport and the podcast world with the Geeg and Pod guys. They'll be doing some great stuff, and there's always plenty of things going on. So, Mark, until then, cheers.
Cheers, mate. And you're right, there is a big game up. Fulham against Brighton and Hove Albion. I tell you what, I can't wait for that one.
Strap yourselves in. Good luck.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.